Faccio bene, faccio bene. Well, I grew up in Paterson, New Jersey. I'll tell you where that is. Anybody here from Paterson? Paterson, New Jersey is about 20 miles west of New York City. And when I was a kid in Paterson, a long time ago, in order to get around in Paterson, you had to belong to a gang. It was just the way it was back then. Things are not a whole lot different. Yes, they are. Today, our kids kill people. They kill each other. We used to just beat the crap out of you years ago, you know, but now we kill each other. But to get around in Paterson, you had to be part of a gang. And I've always been the kind of guy all my life, if I was going to do something, I did it 100%, no matter what. When I drank 100%. You know, no matter what I got involved with, I did it 100%. So I had to belong to a gang, and I knew I had to belong to a gang. So I would pick the toughest gang in Paterson to belong to. And the toughest gang in Paterson, New Jersey, was called the Warlords. I just liked the name of that. You know, we had other gangs called the Sharks, you know, and the Tigers, you know, but the Warlords. It's like, ooh. You know, and I thought they were the toughest gang in Paterson because, first of all, they had two guys in state prison for murder. They had a whole bunch of guys serving time in the county jail, you know, and I thought this has got to be like the toughest gang in Paterson. My mother thought they were the dumbest gang in Paterson for all the same reasons that I thought they were the toughest gang in Paterson. And I got to be a warlord. You know, you get to wear a jacket, you get to be part of this gang. And the warlords were so respected in Paterson that you could walk anywhere in Paterson by yourself with this jacket on, and nobody would bother you. Right? Fabulous. Except for one thing. I was scared to death being a warlord. And I'd stand on a corner in Paterson, and there were four corners. One was a vacant lot. Another was La Groceria Hispania. And there were a bunch of Spanish guys, Puerto Rican guys, that hung out in front of that place. And there was another corner, there was Big Ike's Tavern. And Big Ike served blacks only. And on my corner was the Dublin Rams AC. And that's where all the Irish guys hung out. You know, bookies, you know, the Irish Mafia type guys. And the warlords would be outside, just kind of hanging out. My job in the warlords was to look big. That was my job, you know. Just stand out there and look as big as you can. And I would stand out there scared to death, trying to look as big as I could. Now, every gang, if you know about them, every gang has a little guy. And that little guy's got a big mouth. It's like gang law. It's a requirement. It's a rule, you know. And he'd be out in the corner yelling at these other guys, "Yo, come on over here and say that." And I'd be standing in the back saying, "Oh, please, God, don't let them come over here. I got to serve mass in the morning, you know. And I got this big Irish mother home, you know, and whatever I got out in the street when I went home, she'd give me worse than that, you know. And then the next day, I'd have to go down to the corner, and the guys would say, "Your mother beat you up? You know, I might lose my jacket, you know." But let me tell you, standing on the corner, Paterson, New Jersey, scared to death, part of a gang, you don't know what to do, how to do it, except you're big and you can do what they're asking you to do. And we get one of these winos to buy us a bottle. And the bottle will go around and 10 guys are going to pull on that bottle. And all of a sudden, magic. Whoa. Now you get another bottle go around. Another 15 guys get to pull on the bottle. Whoa. Two or three bottles go by. Next thing I know, I'm out in the corner going, "Yo, come on over here and say that." And I got to tell you, when you're 14 years old, and you're standing on a corner and you're scared to death, and you put something inside of here that makes that fear go away, you remember that. And the next time you get in that situation, you do it again. And it does it again. And the next time you get in that situation, you do it again. And pretty soon you start thinking, "Yeah, I'll probably be scared Friday. Why wait till the last minute?" And that's what I did for the first 33 years of my life. I used alcohol to help me do whatever it was that I had to do. See, I knew that if I drank enough, I could do whatever I wanted to do or had to do to anybody, and I could just not think about it. That's the way I lived. In Paterson, I had about 8 guys lived in my head. Right? About 8 guys. I don't know. I didn't count them up. Maybe been more. But, you know, I had this warlord guy. I had a good football player. I had a good student. We had a guy who was on a debating society. You know, and we had a guy that wanted to be a priest. We don't know where the hell he came from, you know, but he was in there, you know. And when I wanted to make a decision, I had to have like a group meeting, you know, and get all these guys together. And sometimes you get embarrassed, you know, because I'd be serving mass and a warlord guy would come out, you know. The priest would look for the one. I go, what? Eat? What? You know. If you ever seen the movie or if you ever seen the HBO show, what's it called? I forget. The Sopranos. That's me. That's where I grew up. That's my neighborhood. That's where they're shooting it. They threw a guy off the water, off the falls, one of the episodes. That's where I hung out, right there. These are the guys. These guys were my heroes when I was a kid. Fast money, easy money, quick, let's get it done. You know, guys would give you $5. Take this bag, and they'd give you an address. The bag would be full of money, you know, and they would say, don't open the bag. Believe me, I never looked in the bag. You know, my mother worked all day for $5. And I get $5 for walking about 4 or 5 blocks and not looking in the bag. That's where I came from. But I decided what I wanted, what I really wanted for myself, was I had a plan. You know, good. I love to listen to alcoholics when they, you know, my guys, the guys I sponsor, when they say, well, you know, I've been thinking about this and I've got a plan. Oh, yeah? Let me hear it. Long time ago, somebody told me, you want to make God laugh? Tell him your plan for your life. I've had so many plans for my life. That, you know, I had a number of them, index them, you know. And every time I got close to failure, I changed the plan. It was easy. It worked for me. But my plan was to go to college, play professional football, own about 10 car dealerships, and when I retire, when I got to be about 38, and drive through my old neighborhood and just, like, throw money out the window. That was my plan. That was not God's plan for me. God took me a number of different routes, and he got me. You know where? He got me right here tonight. That's where he got me. You know? He got me here. And I'm happier today than I've ever been in my life because I do what he wants me to do. I do what I think he wants me. He don't talk to me. See, if I was God, I wouldn't talk to me. So God don't talk to me. You know, I get kind of feelings. I get directions. I get a way to go. There's a gentle push. There's a gentle suggestion. There's guidance in my life. And I take it today. You know, I used to think that maybe it just started, you know, but I found out that God's been taking care of me for a very long time. And I'll tell you how I found that out. A couple of years ago, my son said to me one day, I was out playing golf with him. He said, I want to thank you and Pat for putting me through college. He said, I'm the only guy that I know that's not paying off a college loan. You know, I thought, yeah, that's really nice. Yeah, that was really nice that he said that. And you know, here's an alcoholic now. I'm driving home from seeing my kid and playing golf with him and having this nice experience where he thanked me. And I was thinking to myself, what an ungrateful son of a man. Did he think I just started taking care of him now? I've been taking care of him since he was a little kid. He never said thank you before. You know, you see these guys, you know, you see those alcoholics driving along the highway, they're talking to the guy in the back seat, and there's nobody there, that's me. Yeah, you're right, you know, you're right. You know? And by the time I'm getting home, I'm saying, tell him. And fortunately, I had one of my guys that I sponsored, who helped me a lot, said to me, that's the way God feels about you. I said, where the hell did you learn that? He said, you told me that. When did I teach you that? I don't know, man. You know, if you're doing this thing the way God wants you to do this thing, things come out of my mouth, and I don't know that I know. I don't. Who said that? You know? And this kid said to me, that's the way God feels. I said, no kidding. So now I know how God feels. You know? God just didn't start taking care of me. Now he's been taking care of me all along. That's how I got here. Because he was taking care of me. So let me go back and tell you what happened to me. You know, I've been the kind of guy, you know, if you play golf, I know you know this guy, Mark. But you're not him, I know that. But yeah, I know you know this guy. I'm the guy who's always calling for the ball. Just give me the ball. You know, just give me the ball. And when I had a plan to go to school, my plan going to school was like, how can I get a college degree as fast as possible? You know, I go to school, you get a football scholarship, and you just like coast through school. You know, and that's it. And I turned down the only offer that I ever got for a football scholarship, hoping that a better school would come along, and nobody else ever came along. So I had no alternatives. I went to school, and I worked. It took me 6 years to get through school, but I was that kind of guy. Give me the book. How do I do it? I went to school Saturdays, Sundays, intercession, you know, you name it. Summers, if there was a time I could go to school, I went to school. Just give me the book. How do I get these credits? How do I get this done? And after 6 years, I worked as a Teamster, and you know, everybody drinks. You know, Teamsters drink. You know Teamsters drink? Right, I was a Teamster. I drove a truck. I got myself through college doing it, and I always found the guys that drank. So here I am now. I'm ending my job as a Teamster, and I'm going to school, and I'm going to teach kids now. And one of the guys in a Teamster said to me, shop steward says to me, hey, Freddie, so I want to ask you, how come you're quitting this job to go teach school? You're going to be making like half as much money teaching school as you're making now. Why would somebody do that? And I thought, and I said, I don't know. See, I was told, you go to school. You got to go to school. So I went to school. That was my plan. So I went to school. And I never stopped to think, like, how much money am I going to be making when I got to school? I went to school. See, I started out to be a psychologist. But I almost failed, so I changed the plan. And then I thought I ought to be a lawyer. And I almost failed, so I changed the plan. So I ended up being a teacher. And I already am teaching school, making half as much money as I did when I was driving a truck. And I don't know. And when I was teaching school for about 4 months, I realized I made a grave error in judgment. See, I hate these kids. You know, I'm hanging out where I always hung out, and I'm drinking all night, playing cards, gambling with these guys, and I got to go in there, and I got 30 of these kids in a room. And they're saying, can I go in the bathroom? You know, you can go home. I don't care, you know. I'm dying in here. My head's killing me, you know. I'm dying. I'm trying to get through the day on 12 Slim Jims that I had the night before. You know, my body got percolating. I feel like a coffee pot inside. And this kid wants to know if he can go home, you know. I was sitting in the teacher's room one day. And the guy says to me, he says, it sounds like you need to make more money. I said, well, yeah, I do. He said, well, how do you make money in education? He says, you got to be a principal. I said, well, how do you get to be a principal? He says, well, you know, you got to go to school. School. Give me the ball, man. Come on, school. This is easy. What is it? You know? He says, well, here's the deal. You know, if you're teaching now, you go to school, 2 or 3, 4 years, you'll finish your degree, then you'll have to get to be, you know, whatever they call them, senior teacher in school, and you'll probably in about 8, 9 years, you'll get to be assistant principal. Do that for a few years, and you get to be principal. Just give me the ball. Just give me the ball. 3 years later, I'm assistant principal. Piece of cake. Piece of cake. Nothing to this, man. Just feed the fool, you know? And I figured out how to do it. I got in school, I got the job, I got the degree, and I did what I wanted to do. Now, I don't know anything about education in California. All right, nothing. But I assume maybe that assistant principals do the same thing here that they do in New Jersey. In New Jersey, they're in charge of discipline. So now when I go to school every day, I got 30 of the worst kids in the building in my office. I hated the good ones. Now I got these tough guys saying, so what, I cut, you know, so, you know. And my plan was, we'll just wait till the parents go away on vacation, and then we'll get rid of them. Superintendent frowned on that. He said, it's not going to make for good relations with the public, and we won't get the budget through, you know, so I did the next best thing. I went out and drank at lunch night. Now when I come back, every once in a while, I got one of these little girls say, is that beer on your back? You smell just like my father. Hey, does your father drink? All right. So, but I am making more money. Now, here's a good Albert Pollock plan. I want to show this to you because I want you to recognize it when you hear one, when you got that guy in the back seat giving you one. Here's a good alcoholic plan. 3 years of college, several thousand dollars. All right. 3 years of graduate school, 6 years of college, several thousand dollars. And here I am, assistant principal, with 30 of the worst kids in the building, making exactly the same amount of money I did when I was driving a truck as a Teamster. That's a good alcoholic plan. All right, now I'm making all this money as assistant principal. So I said to my wife, my first wife, her name was Pat, and I suggest that any alcoholics in the group, if you have a number of wives, it's very convenient if you have them all named the same. This way you can never make a mistake. So my first wife was named Pat, and I said, come on, honey, we're going to go out, we're going to go buy a house. And we went looking for a house. And I meet a guy that I used to teach school with who's now selling houses. So I said, well, hey, Barry, I said, you know, how are you doing? He said, oh, I'm making money. I said, well, how are you making all this money? He said, I'm selling houses, I'm a real estate salesman. I said, hey, how do you get to be a real estate salesman? Gotta go to school. He says, just give me the ball, man, you know? How long is this school? 16 weeks. Nothing to this. I just compressed a 9-year career into 3 years. Give me the ball. Just give me the ball. 16 weeks later, I'm a real estate salesman. Got rid of the kids. I'm selling real estate. This is whenever this was, 1969, 70, 71, probably 1971. I'm selling real estate. And I'm making money. You could hardly miss. I'm making money, and we're making lots of money. And I'm having a great time. You see, now when I go out to lunch, there's none of these kids that I got to worry about, you know. And I can go out and drink, and I made a lot of deals in bars. That's what I used to tell my wife. I got to be there. I got to be where the action is, you know. And I'm here today, sober man, and I want to tell you, I never made a deal in a bar. I lost several deals in a bar, but I never made a deal in a bar. But here I am now, and I'm making all this money. And I'm sitting in the office one day, and I see this broker guy come in. He's driving a Cadillac. I'm driving a Chevy. I'm paying for that Cadillac. Good alcoholic plan starts to surface. So I go to Harold. I say, Harold, how do you make the real money in real estate? Got to be a broker. Harold, how do you get to be a broker? Got to go to school. How easy is this? 4 weeks of school, and I'm a real estate broker. Piece of cake, give me the ball. Let's go. 4 weeks later, I'm a real estate broker. A year later, I'm a real estate broker and a builder. And I got to tell you, here's how God took me around. He took me around. He got me in this real estate office big time, big time, big time. You know, I'm driving a Cadillac. I'm doing anything I want to do. I play golf every day. I drink. And I drink. Sometimes I play golf. Fact is, I just drank. Most of the time, that's what I did. I drank and I gambled and I chased women. And sometimes I played God. Sometimes. And in the middle of this, when we're making money like crazy, my partner and I would turn around. Every time we turn around, people are handing us money. That was probably the worst thing that could have ever happened to me. And I can talk about it now. I can tell you that because I don't have it anymore. It's gone. It's gone. I went through it. I don't have it. It's gone. Nothing ever left. Not a cent. Gone. Everything I ever made. My main goal in life, God. It's amazing to me that we stand up here and talk about the things that we lost and how we went through all this stuff. And people blow their brains out for these things. You know, and we say to them, it's gone. I don't have it anymore. Well, what are you going to do? I don't know. Well, what are you going to do? I don't know. Well, what if, I don't know. So I turn my life and will over to care of God. He takes care of me. Not in certain situations in my life. So I don't know. And he took care of me. He guided me and shaped me and brought me in a direction. And I'm going to tell you how that happened. He got me here. He got me here probably the only way he could get me here. He got me here. We put an ad in the paper. And I had this partner, Dennis. And Dennis was a charmer. You know, he had one of those little devilish looks. You know, and he'd look at you and people just say, oh, all right. And they sign a contract, you know. I mean, you have to trust him. He's such a nice boy, you know. And I took advantage of everybody I could like that. I said, how about meeting the builder? Dennis, go on with Dennis. All right, you know. And then sign a check. All right. Now, what happened was that we put an ad in the paper. And we used to charm all the women that worked for us. And we had a hard time finding women to work for us after a while. We were so charming. So we put an ad. We put an ad in the paper. And this woman responds to this ad in the paper. And she said on the phone, she said all the right things. She said, I know that you're a young, progressive firm. I said, yeah. Yeah, that's me. I know you're headed right to the top. Yeah, that's me. That's me. And I really would like to be a part of your team. I got plans for her already. I didn't even see her, and I got plans for her. And I said, well, when can you come in? And she said, as soon as you want me in. I said, tomorrow. And she walks in, and she sits down in my office. And I have degrees that would tell you that I know how to interview people, but I was drunk when I got those degrees, so I really don't know how to interview people very well. Besides which, it was before lunch, and I had pressing matters at Hester Prynne's down the road. And Hester Prynne is the lady, the Scarlet Letter lady, you know, so you can imagine the kind of place that it was that I had this pressing engagement. And this woman comes in and she sits down in front of me and she crosses her legs. And I thought, nice legs. You're hired. So I had to leave. I had to get out of there. And she said, well, I don't know how to type. I said, no problem. Legs like that, we'll get you a course. You'll know how to type no time at all. Now, before she left, she said, I want you to know something. I'm an alcoholic. I come from Patterson. I know alcoholics. I know what they look like, you know. They got World War I overcoats on. They got paper stuffed in here. They got bottles of nitrate in here, you know. But I had a pressing engagement down at Hester Prynne. So if she wants to be an alcoholic, let her be an alcoholic. And when I said, that's fine. And then I hired her. And she's here tonight. She spoke this morning. You see, so if you're a good secretary and you have nice legs and you're an AA and you get hired by somebody and you get them sober, they'll marry you. That's what I did. So here she comes to work for me. And then she knows what she's got right away. You know, she's got a drunk. She's got a live-action drunk right here. You know, and I would go out to lunch, and I went to lunch at 10:30. I had a good seat. This was a go-go joint. And I had a good seat. I'd stay till 4:30 or 5, and then I would come back, because I'm making these deals. And then, you know, so then I'd come back 4:30, 5 o'clock, and I'd go through the messages and throw most of them away. And I'd decide who might have a chance of getting called back tomorrow. And then I would stop for a drink on the way home. After a day like I had to stop for a drink on the way home. And I would go in the next morning, and I'd be dying because I've been out all night playing cards and gambling and drinking and chasing women. And I would go into the office, and you know how cruel they are when they know they got you? And Pat would stick her head in the office, and she'd say, good morning. Before long, I started saying, good morning. Because it's infectious. That good feeling that you have is infectious. And I wanted that. You know, we reached a point very quickly where I wanted what she had. And I was willing to go to any lengths to get it. Including an AA meeting. Because I'm the kind of guy, when I want something, it's 100%. Give me the ball. And she came in one day and she said, I'm celebrating today. And I said, this is it. Celebration. I know how to celebrate. I'm celebrating tonight at the Newton Group, and I have 3 years of sobriety, and I'd like you to come. Of course she does. I'll be there. I'll be there. So I go to the Newton Group. And I want to tell you, I was surprised when I walked in the Newton Group, Alcoholics Anonymous, because there was this mahogany bar. And I said, of course, this is how they teach you. They wean you off. You know, and they got like probably a master bartender. They line up all the alcoholics, and he just goes crazy. You know, and you got like a ration card. You get 8 drinks tonight, 7 tomorrow, 6 on Thursday. Basic cake. I'll get my ration card, I'll have the 8 drinks, and I'll get out of here with her. Nothing to it. And they had a rail there, by the way. They had a rail. Something I miss here tonight. But they had a rail, you know, and I know how to do this. I got up to the rail and just looked down the line, see who was there and who wasn't. And I realized something. Nobody was drinking. Oh, they were drinking. Coffee. So this is probably some kind of like preliminary event that they have. And the real things will come out later on. But as I stood there and talked to these people, they were talking good stuff. They were talking. They were saying words like serenity, peace of mind. Peace of mind. When you're a big timer like me, and you got guys chasing you, and I got chasing you, and you're doing deals like I'm doing, you don't get peace of mind. Now that did not sober me up that night, but it stayed in my head. I wondered how they did this. All these people got up and celebrated various lengths of sobriety, and I was intrigued by this. I thought, there's just a system here that I don't understand. And it didn't sober me up, but it stayed in my mind. And I lost that real estate business. I lost that construction business. I lost everything I ever had. The sheriff came and took my car out of the driveway. My wife threw me out. My ex-wife, Pat, got everything we ever had. I got all the bills that were left. And I got to start over. And being the kind of guy I am, I called for the ball again. I said, just give me the ball. It's a piece of cake. I'll show you how to do this. I got another job. And I got things going in the right direction. And I screwed that up again. And I got another job. And I got everything going in the right direction. And I screwed that up again. And I got another job. And I believe God steered me to this job. Because I was working on a job in Pennsylvania, pounding nails. Pounding nails. I used to be vice president of sales for this company. And I was pounding nails now for the same company. And I got a newspaper coming back from Pennsylvania to New Jersey on a Thursday. I got last Sunday's newspaper, Good Alcoholic Thinking. Let me get last Sunday's paper and see if any of those jobs are still available Thursday. And I called a job that seemed tailor-made for me. And they were advertising in this New Jersey paper. It was a company from Ohio. And they were looking to hire somebody to work in that New Jersey area. And I got on a plane that Thursday to Saturday, and I went to Columbus, Ohio, and they hired me. And they sent me to train with a guy in Philadelphia, who ended up being my mentor. Now, I know when you're new, you like to think about coincidences. Stick around a while. There are no coincidences. This is God's plan. I ended up going to Dallas, Texas with that guy from Pennsylvania about a year and a half later to work at the Builder Show in Dallas. And on January 21st, 1976, I was standing at a bar in Dallas. And that man was standing next to me. And I had my last drink on that day, and I'll tell you how this deal happened. You know, when I drank, see, I couldn't drink that whole week we were working the convention because at this point in my life, I worked or I drank. And if I was drinking, I wasn't working. If I was working, I couldn't be drinking. So I had to work that week in Dallas because we had to go down there and we had to make the show. We had to make the show. It meant we had to sell enough merchandise down there that we paid for the show and made money for the company. So I'm down there in Dallas and I couldn't drink that week. But come Friday when we cracked the nut, when we made what we were supposed to make, and I made the deal that I was assigned to make that week at the convention, I went right to the bar. And standing next to me at the bar was a man named Alan. And I had my first scotch. I threw it down right away. And it hit like it hit on a corner when I was a kid. And the muscles came back. And the bravado came up. That swagger that she was talking about this morning was there. And the head was bobbing. You know, and I ordered the second one. And that personality change they talk about in the book started to take place. Big time came back. I'm here. And I turned to Alan. Now, I'm in a Fairmont Hotel in Dallas, Texas. If you ever been there, it's a big deal, or at least it was in 1976. And I turned to Alan and I said, "Hey, Alan, what do you think they'd take for this place?" He said, "About $80 million." And I said, "I'll probably need a partner, preferably one with $80 million. And Alan turned around and he looked me in the eye. And I believe he looked into my soul that night and saw the nothing that was me. He saw the jello, the non-man. That was there, the front, the facade. That was me. And I got on a plane the next day. I did not drink again. Have not drank since that day. He saw me. He knew me. And I don't know if he knows what he saw. But I thought he saw that. And that was enough. I had a guy, a friend of mine, wrote a book, and he said, "Everybody comes to their moment of truth." I think that was my moment of truth. I don't know that Alan, to this day, ever knows. We'll know what he did in that bar. But God used him. He put him there. See, I respected this guy. Marine Corps aviator, Vietnam veteran, number one salesman in the company. He was what I lied about. He was what I pretended to be in a bar when I didn't have enough confidence in myself or what I had, my own self-esteem. And I would tell you I was him. And he looked at me in that way. And I stopped drinking that day. And I came back to New Jersey and I went to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I went to this meeting and I had been in a couple of times before. And I walked in this meeting and it was a long hallway, probably 100 feet or so. And I'm looking at this guy at the door and I said, "Oh, no, not him." guy we used to call Smiling Jack, he was always smiling and laughing, and I used to look at this guy and say, what the hell is so funny? How is he having such a good time? Don't you hear the misery that these people are talking? And he was always laughing and joking. And I opened the door, and I had that spiritual awakening at that bar in Dallas. And I opened that door, and I saw Jack, and I immediately began to think, if he says one thing I don't like, I'm going to duck him right there. And I walk down that hall, and I'm walking, and he's looking, and he's smiling, and I'm walking, and I get up there, and he says, how you doing, kid? And I said, I'm here, and I'm willing to do anything you tell me. And I want to grab those words and pull them back, because I wasn't sure I wanted to do that. But God made me say those words. And Jack said, good, go on inside, sit down, and shut up. And I wished I had decked him when I saw him out of the hall. See, Jack was one of those guys we don't hear a lot of today. He had those gravelly voice because he drank a lot of booze, you know, messed up his vocal cords. And, you know, Jack called me dummy all the time. Dummy. Come here, dummy. And I would go over there. Late at night, I would wake up and I would say to myself, nobody talks to me like that. And when we have one of these group conscience meetings, one of these things where we assign our jobs, he'd say, dummy, he'll do it. Assign our jobs, he'd say, dummy, he'll do it. Right, dummy? Yeah, I'll do it. What I found out was Jack had launched an all-out assault on my ego. He took my inner child out and stomped on it. And in so doing, he saved my life. Jack volunteered me to wash ashtrays. This is when we could smoke in meetings. We washed ashtrays. He said, dummy, I'll wash the ashtrays, right, dummy? I said, yeah, I'll wash the ashtrays. And I had these ashtrays, and I said, I'm the kind of guy. If Fred's going to wash ashtrays, Fred's going to wash ashtrays better than anyone in AA has ever washed ashtrays. So I would be there after the meeting, done with that, you need that, help me, I had that, get it back in the kitchen, wash, rub, clean, shine, up on the shelf, I'm back out, talk to the people. That's how you do it. All right? And I did this, and I tell you, I said to Jack, I got an idea. Head starts to bob. Dummy's got an idea. What's the idea, dummy? I said, you know, I saw these, like, aluminum ashtrays. Like, you use them, and then when you're done with them, you throw them away. Yeah. Well, why don't we buy them for the group? I'll tell you why we don't buy them for the group. Because then you would be absolutely no use whatsoever to this group. I went back inside and started washing the ashtrays. 2 years. 2 years. I washed ashtrays. I had another idea once. I went out and I said to Jack, don't you think I washed ashtrays enough? He said, no. I washed ashtrays for another 6 months. One night I'm in there, and we had this little, I feel like I'm there now, we had this little cutout in the wall, and the sink was there. And you could stand at the sink, and you could look through the wall, and you could see the people in the meeting. You could see all the people having fun after the meeting, sharing fellowship, while I washed ashtrays. And I was in there one night doing ashtrays, get them clean, bottle shaped, and I could feel somebody staring at me. And I looked up, and it was Jack. I said, well, give me some ashtray. And he was standing there like this against the wall. And he smiled at me and shook his head. And my heart just filled. Because I knew I was going to be okay. I got approval from this guy. He never said a kind word to me. But I just got an approval. That's going to have to do what I just got. I knew. We never talked about that. what I knew. I knew I was there and I was doing what I was supposed to be doing when I was supposed to be doing it, and if I continued to do that, I'd be okay. It's that simple. It didn't cost me $120 an hour. It cost me a buck. Sometimes I stole the buck, but it cost me a buck. You know, I went to a psychologist one time for a long time. I actually went to a psychologist trying to get help. And he used to say to me, well, how are we today? It's the wee stuff, man. I've been out breaking my back all week to get this $120 for you, you know. And I had to lie to him. You know, I don't want him to think that of me, you know. So I had to lie to him, you know. And here for a buck, I got this plumber. I didn't tell you that before. Jack's a plumber. Dad, these degrees. I'm an educated man. And God did this to me. He gave me a plumber as a sponsor. A plumber that would call me dummy. A plumber. And I would say, Jack, I've got these degrees. And he would give me that rhetoric. Thermometers have degrees. And you know the rest. Jack didn't teach me things. He didn't tell me things. He showed me things. He showed me by the way he lived his life how I should live my life. Jack, the first year that I was getting sober, Jack picked me up every night and took me to a meeting. He was there. It was not a question, where would you like to go to another meeting? Where would you like to go? What kind of meetings do you like to go? We never shared that. It was, be downstairs tomorrow night, 7:30, I'll pick you up. And for some reason, I went upstairs, did what I had to do the next day, and I was downstairs 7:30 the next night, and he picked me up. And he did that for a year. And I would cry to him, and I'd tell him, Jack, you know, the IRS is after me. He said, well, it's because you didn't file for 5 years. What the hell do you want? I haven't got a commission check in 6 months. Well, you don't do any goddamn work. That's why you didn't get a commission check. And I would cry to him every night. My wife, my ex-wife, she's not going to let me see the kid for Christmas. You know, what am I going to do? Something else, he said. He was so kind and so warm and so understanding that he saved my life. But I'm going to tell you how, that's just serious stuff. The whole first year I was getting sober, Jack picked me up and he took me around. And he would buy me coffee. He would say, here, kid, here's the money. Get your suit out of the cleaners. Go to work. Go to work tomorrow. Here, pay your phone bill. Here's a cigar. I ain't seen you smoking a cigar in a while. Here's a cigar for you, kid. You know, that's what he would do. And that whole first year, he took me around. And somebody else told me what was going on in Jack's life. Jack's wife was dying of cancer. And 1 week out of every month, she would go in the hospital and get chemotherapy treatment. And while she was in the hospital, he would take care of the kids. He had three kids, two little girls, and he would iron their dresses, and he would cook their meals, and he would make their lunches for the next day before he'd come out and pick me up at 7:30 and take me to the meeting. And he did that for a year, and you know what? He never said a word about that. And he taught me, you do what you got to do in this program for that next drunk, and you never say a word. He taught me you never say no in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, he taught me those things that I know about being a sober man, about being a productive citizen. He taught me that. He taught me to never say no in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'll tell you how he taught me that. He showed me. He got me one night, he said to me, here, come here, dummy. Come here. You know, you got a minute? You know, come here. I love to do that to newcomers today, especially when I'm a little jittery. Come here. Great. Stick around long enough, you get to pass it on. That's what that whole book is about. If you haven't read the book, it tells you how to do that stuff. Not really. Come here, dummy. Here, read this. And he hands me a grapevine. Now, when Jack told you read this, you're going to get quizzed on this next time he sees you. You're going to have a little exam, a little oral test on this. And I thought, you know, it's time. It's time that I showed this plumber what a man of my accomplishments can do with this rinky-dink literature that he's given. So I went to my apartment. I had this apartment because my sister threw me out of the camper that I was living in her driveway. So I had to send it to a level of apartment. Actually, I sent it to a level of empty apartment. Because what I had in the apartment was a sleeping bag and a TV. And she loaned me the TV. I stole the sleeping bag. But I had a box of books. Because an educated man is never without his books. Whether he reads them or not, you need to have them. In this box, I had a yellow legal pad. And I had a dictionary. And I had a Bible. I don't know why I had the Bible. I never read it. I still haven't read it. But I had it. And I opened this magazine. And this particular grapevine happened to be on spiritual awakenings. In the first paragraph, first page, first article, first paragraph, it said, it's about spiritual awakening. It said, if you are now doing something which you could not have done previously on your unaided will alone, you probably have already had one. And I thought, what the hell does that mean? These people are supposed to be trying to help me. What does that mean? And I looked at the words, and the words just wouldn't go together into a thought, and I thought I'd better define the words. So I looked up spiritual in the Doubleday Dictionary, and I found that there were 7 definitions in the Doubleday Dictionary. One of them said, of or pertaining to the highest levels of character or morals in a human being. Spiritual. Of or pertaining to the highest level of character or morals in a human being. So maybe a spiritual awakening could be an awakening of the higher level of character and morals in this human being. And I thought about that, and I thought, my God, you know, I'm not doing some of the things that I used to do. Maybe it's already happened. That's what they said in the book. And I began to read and study, and that little flame, that little flicker, that little glow has been fanned and brought along. And today I believe in a guy. I believe in this power. I believe in this power that when I need it, it's there. And all I have to do is pass it on to somebody else. All I have to do is not do what I think. All I have to do is do what he seems to want me to do. That's all I have to do. And I read that article. And when Jack asked me the next time, I was able to tell him. New information. Now, I know that I impressed him with that information. But he said, so what? And I knew I impressed him. I know. You know how I know I impressed him? Because I heard him saying it at a meeting about 3 weeks later. That's how I know I impressed him. I tell you that little story because this other story, Jack told me, never say no in Alcoholics Anonymous. Never say no in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I came home from building a house on Long Island one day, and I had driven about 3 hours from where I was. It was hot. There was no air conditioner in the truck. And I was a guy that went out on a job and showed you how to put these prefabricated houses together. Whenever there was a problem, I drove back, and I said, tonight I'm just staying home. I'm just staying home. I'm turning on that air conditioner. I'm watching a ball game, and that's it. That's it. I had no responsibility. You know those nights when you have no AA responsibilities whatsoever? I'm done. I'm staying in. And I got in the house, and there was Jack's voice on the answering machine. Now, here's the message. You will meet me at Hunterdon Medical Center at 8 o'clock tonight. No, it's not happening. Not happening. Not tonight, air conditioner ball game, not happening. It's about time I stood up to this little plumber and let him know. So I called him up and I said, Jack, I'm not going. He said, yes, you are. You're speaking. And he hung up. So I got in a car and I drove to Hunterdon Medical Center. Another hour and a half away. And I got up that night to speak. And I told that story I just told you about that grapevine. And there was a little lady sitting right about in the middle of the room right where you are. And she kept shaking her head. And I thought, my God, I'm saving this woman. Look at this. Look at this. I said, this is it, Nancy. It's never going to be the same after tonight. And I'm telling that story. You know, and after the meeting, she came up to me and she said, do you know who wrote that article? I said, no, I don't. She said, my husband did. And he's sitting right there. And she pointed to this frail little man who had no hair, who was dying of cancer. And I thought to myself, as I have many times since, what kind of program do we have here?
that would get my sponsor, Jack, to teach me to never say no in Alcoholics Anonymous, that would get me from this job site in Long Island, 3 hours away, to go home, take a direction from a man that I respected, that I wanted to be like, to get in the car, to clean up, to suit up, and show up another hour and a half away, so that old man could hear me thank him for reintroducing me to God before he died. That's the kind of program. That's the power that I believe in this program. That's a part, being a part of that. To this day, it's many, many years ago now, it still thrills me. And I've done a lot of thrilling things in my life, and that still thrills me. I want to tell you about a guy that I sponsor. I'm a big book dumper, and I don't make any excuses for that. It's only the directions. If you want to know the directions, how it's supposed to be done, you know. But I'm not going to thump tonight. I want to tell you about something I read in the 12 and 12 on page 177 in the 12 and 12. It says, since recovery is life itself to us, it is imperative that we preserve with full strength our means of survival. This program. That's our means of survival. And I had a guy come to me, and he said, I really like what you say at meetings, and I'd like you to be my sponsor. And I remember when I did that to Jack, and Jack said to me, are you expressing a wish or are you asking a question? So I said to this man, are you expressing a wish or are you asking a question? He said, what do you mean? I said, well, what did you just say? He said, I would like you to be my sponsor. I said, are you expressing a wish or are you asking a question? He said, I would like you to be my sponsor. And I said, I have to think about this. You see, he's a very high-bottom junk. He graduated from the Air Force Academy. He's retired military. He's a corporate pilot. And he's a high-bottom junk. I used to get maniacs, crazy guys, you know. They're the ones that nobody else wants to deal with. Those are the guys that seek me out. I don't know why. I'm such a nice man. But maybe my wife can explain that to you. But I said, I have to talk to my sponsor about this. And I called my sponsor and I said, what do we do? And he said, no, you have to be a sponsor. You have to be a sponsor, but you do not have to compromise your principles to be his sponsor. You see, he needs to learn the whole program of Alcoholics Anonymous, not just the abridged version for those people that are Air Force Academy graduates and corporate pilots. And my wife will tell you that she thinks I'm probably enjoying this a little too much, but I really, really am enjoying teaching this man, this retired major, about Alcoholics Anonymous. He's been sober now about 4 years, and about 3 years ago he came to me on a Saturday night and he said they would like me to lead this meeting on Saturday night, the step meeting. And I said, I don't know how you can lead this meeting. He said, what do you mean? He said, I've been sober a year. I said, yeah, but I don't remember you ever making coffee at this meeting. He said, oh, you have to make coffee at the meeting? I said, yeah, that's what you have. So he volunteered to make coffee. And I really love that. 3 months later he came back to me and he said, can I leave the meeting? I said, no. He said, why not? I made coffee. I said, you asked me. Now you have to make coffee again. So we got the idea. 6 months went by. He made coffee. I went to him and I said, you can leave the meeting. And he led the meeting. You see, this man today, and I live to see the day, and Pat will tell you, we know it, we mark it, because I heard him at a meeting quoting the big book to a newcomer. And where we come from, people discount the big book. If you want to hide something from our people, you put it in the big book. Nobody looks there. I heard this retired Air Force guy quoting a big book. That's why I had to be a sponsor. That's why I had to learn that I can help those people, that there is a way, and that we have to preserve what we've got at a certain level. And I'm so happy to be here talking to you folks, because my group at home tries to fashion itself after the Pacific Group. We hear a lot about you, and we run a no-nonsense meeting, and believe me, there aren't many around my area. Well, you come here, you are dressed the way I am dressed tonight, out of respect for your sponsor, out of respect for your home group, and AA in general. That is something we do not compromise on, and I'm so happy to see that that's here, and that's where it came from. Pat and I do a lot of traveling, and we get all over the place, and I don't want to keep you very long, but I want to tell you just a couple of things, and just share with you some of the things that have happened. You know, we love each other, Pat and I. She told me that this morning. You know, this is an AA marriage that works. You know, most of them that we know about don't work, or they have problems. You know, it is a problem sometimes. We have to work at this. You know, we went one time. Pat has a lot of stuff you know, from the past, you know, and she has to understand it. I'm so glad my past is over. I don't want to think about it anymore. But she has to understand it. And we went to the therapist, and the therapist said, you have to understand that when Pat says these things to you, when she yells and shouts and screams at you, that she's not really talking to you. It's something from her past, and it's her ex-husband. And you have to say to her, I'm not him. I don't treat you that way. And I told the therapist, oh, yeah, no, that's the first thing I think of when... You know, I'm going to deck the bitch, you know what I mean? So one night when she was yelling and shouting and screaming at me, I turned to her and I said, Hannah, I'm not your ex-husband. I love you. I'm not him. And she started to cry. And the little girl was there. So I got a son. I have a son. Pat has three kids. I have a son. My son's 6'5". He's a great big guy. Good kid. I never had a little girl. Pat's my little girl. You know? So I got to have a little girl. Sometimes I say to her, you're my little girl. You're my princess. I take care of you. So I'm going to be a father to my wife. I don't know how that works. Alcoholics understand. I share it with you. You know what I mean? You know? She's my princess. I take care of her. You know? And we travel around and we work at this thing. And I found myself one time in Cashiers, North Carolina. And it was Mother's Day, and I said to her, honey, you can go any place you want. Any place you want. Now, I don't even know where Cashiers, North Carolina is right now, but it's nowhere you want to be, I'm telling you. And she said, I want to go to this place called the White Goose. The White Goose. Well, I said, anywhere you want to go, sweetheart, I'll take you to the White Goose if you want to go there. And I went to the White Goose, and we sit down, and they bring us a menu, and it says on the back of the menu, things we can learn from geese. Oh, gosh. This is about the most I could ever do for this woman. Now, if you had a sponsor like I had a sponsor, if you had that kind of sponsor, his voice is in your head. And you will never, years after he's dead, probably to the day I die, his voice will be there. And I heard that scraggly old voice saying to me, the only chance a guy like you has is to make everything he's got a learning situation. What could I possibly learn from geese? So with that mental challenge, I began to read what's on the menu. And I thought, you know, these are things that alcoholics could learn from geese. So let me try you out. First thing you said is that geese, when they fly together in formation, they have found that they can fly 70% further because they fly together. Alcoholics can learn that from geese. It said that geese, when one gets sick or injured, two other geese follow it to the ground and stay with it until it dies or it's able to fly again. Alcoholics can learn that from geese. It said that when a goose falls out of formation, it immediately feels the drag of trying to fly on its own, so it gets back into formation. Alcoholics could learn that from geese. All those people, you say, how you doing? Fine. They could learn that. It said, when geese, do we have geese? When they fly over, you hear them, they honk, honk, honk. Those are the geese in the back. And they honk so that the geese in the front, that are the pace setters, will know that the geese in the back are getting closer. So it's the geese in the back that are doing the honking. Alcoholics already know that. You got them out here, too, right? Call them bleeding deacons, old-timers, right? You know, I got to be careful. I'm starting to get to be one. Now, let me one more thing about geese. Did you ever notice when they fly over that one side of that V is longer than the other? Do you know why that is? There's more geese on that side. It's a fact. You see, some things are just too hard for a room full of alcoholics to figure out. The only chance a guy like you has is to make every situation into a learning situation. I just shared with you some of the benefits of that. I had a sponsor that told me, you got to make everything you have, every situation you find yourself into a learning situation. It's your only chance. It's your only chance. I just shared the benefits of that with you. Since I've been sober, I've had a lot of opportunities to go back and straighten things out. It's part of our deal. It's what we do. The book tells you that you'll never get sober and stay sober unless you do your utmost to straighten out the past. And I owe money to people. I owe money to people that were going to kill me. I had a lot of problems I had to solve. And I've addressed those things. I've been able to go back and make a lot of things right. You know, I was a bad father. First 3 years my son was alive, but wasn't around. I couldn't pick him out in the crowd. I didn't know what he looked like. Never spending time with him. You know, and I had the opportunity to go back and do that right. You know, Pat and I, when he was 14 years old, I was sober 10 years, you know, we were able to get him to come live with us and get him away from his alcoholic mother because I stayed sober, because I did what I was supposed to do. And we offered him a sane, sober household to live in, and we brought him up, and we sent him to college. And I have this kid now, and I am a good father to him. And whenever I see him or talk to him on a phone, I say, Eric, I love you, Eric. Nobody ever told me to love me. My father was never around. My father got killed in a bar fight when I was 4. And I changed that. I changed that alcoholic destiny in my kid's life. I changed that. And his father, he'll hear my voice past my time. He'll hear my voice saying, I love you. Something I don't know. I never heard. So I changed that. I made it right. I was married to a woman named Pat, and I was a bad husband to that woman. I did horrible things to her. I did terrible things to her. I made her feel worthless. I made her feel less than. I abused her, not only emotionally, financially. I abused her. I signed her name to documents. I falsified things. I caused her a lot of debt and problems. And she still hates me to this day. If she were here tonight, she has no time for me. She can't stand me. And I don't feel good about that, but I know that I've done what I can to straighten that mess out. And my sponsor over the years has taught me that, you know, I can't do any more than I've done. I've been a responsible father to our son, and I tried to make amends to her the best I could. And I did straighten out the financial mess that I involved her in. But how I do that today is I am a good husband to that woman right there. I treat her the best I can. I do everything in my power to make her a happy person. That's how I make this deal right. That's how I'm making my amends with that deal. You know, I was a liar and a cheat and a thief in business. You know, I stole from people. I did things that we shouldn't do in business. Anything I had to do to make a buck. And today I work in a field, in a business, and I do more than they pay me for. I make sure that I do more. You know, I drive myself harder than anybody that works for me to accomplish what needs to be accomplished. Because that's how I put it back in. You know, my sponsor told me that if you can't find the person, then you have to do something else to make it right. And that's how I do this deal. You know, I work at this job, been about it, and it has been very successful because of the effort that I put in. There's only one thing that has been a problem in my life I have not been able to go back and straighten out, and that is my relationship with my mother. You know, my mother told me my father died in a bar fight, an alcoholic in a bar fight, and I was always in trouble when I was a kid, you know, because of my size and my mouth. And she would say to me, you know, you're going to end up just like your father. And at a point in time, and I congratulate her for that, she told me, don't come here when you're drinking. She never went to Al-Anon. She never got any kind of help. She didn't understand alcoholism, but she knew she didn't want what she had. So she said to me, don't come here when you're drinking. And I was always drinking, so I never went there. And one night, I got a phone call from my sister, who lived with my mother, and she said, you need to get here right away. Mommy's dying. And it was the middle of the night, and I knew I couldn't drive like I was, so I got up and I looked in the refrigerator, and there were about 5 cans of beer in there. I thought, well, it's, you know, a couple of cans of beer, and I'll make that hour drive. And a good alcoholic looking at 5 knows 2 ain't going to do it. So I had 3 and 4, and by the time I finished the 5th one, the phone call came back, and my sister said, don't hurry, she's dead. So I was not able to go there and see my mother before she died to tell her I'm sorry or do anything to straighten that out. So I'm left with that memory and that situation. And I've been told over the years that the only thing I have, the only thing I have is the fact that I'm here in Alcoholics Anonymous tonight. That's all I got.